We have some of our young people joining us as they learn about humanism in their classes today, and they are joining us for our sermon. Good people, we are playing with the order of service today, so we haven't forgotten anything. We're just jumping around a little bit. So, in no other way than I can begin a sermon on humanism, or some version of it, I offer you the poetry of Stephen Dunn, entitled At the Smithville Methodist Church. It was supposed to be arts and crafts for a week, but when she came home with the Jesus Saves button, we knew what art was up, what ancient craft. She liked her little friends. She liked the songs they sang when they weren't twisting and folding paper into dolls. What could be so bad? Jesus had been a good man, and putting faith in good men was what we had to do to stay on the side of cynicism, that other sadness. Okay, we said, 1 week. But when she came home singing, Jesus loves me, the Bible tells me so, it was time to talk. Could we say Jesus doesn't love you? Could I tell her that the Bible is a great book certain people use to make you feel bad? We sent her back without a word. It had been so long since we believed, so long since we needed Jesus as our nemesis and friend, that we thought he was sufficiently dead, that our children would think of him like Lincoln or Thomas Jefferson. Soon, you can't teach disbelief to a child. Only wonderful stories. And we hadn't a story nearly as good. On parents' night, there were the arts and crafts all spread out like appetizers. Then we took our seats in the church, and the children sang a song about the ark and hallelujah, and one in which they had to jump up and down for Jesus. I can't remember ever feeling so uncertain about what's comic and what's serious. Evolution is magical but devoid of heroes. You can't say to your child, evolution loves you. The story stinks of extinction, and nothing exciting happens for centuries. I didn't have a wonderful story for my child, and she was beaming. All the way home in the car, she sang the songs, occasionally standing up for Jesus. There was nothing to do but drive, ride it out, and sing along in silence. At the last Roots class, where we talk of the evolution of Unitarian Universalist history and theology and how it is that we came to be whatever it is that we are today, Ed Dilbrowski asked one of the final questions. We had covered Jesus' death and Constantine's rule. We had discussed Ralph Waldo Emerson's conversions and the extremes of Universalism. We spoke of the Humanist Manifesto, the death of God movement, and still, as always, there is more to say. So when Ed raised his hand from the front row, gently prodding just as he did while on my search committee those 4 years ago, and asked, "What has happened to all of the humanists?" I thought of this poem and how you can't tell a child evolution loves you. Unitarian Universalists are such an interesting species of religion. We pride ourselves on our open doors for theological plurality, the boast of our like-mindedness. We recall the ancient words of one of our first Unitarians, Francis David, and love to recite that beautiful phrase, "We need not think alike to love alike," but we are quick to startle, to recoil, to retreat when we come to learn that we are not of one political note in this space. It's such a shame, in my view, that we set ourselves up with these catchphrases of simplicity as if it is easy or right to love someone, to commune with someone who thinks maybe your personhood is not worthy. as if her adamant disbelief in a higher power doesn't make him feel foolish for finding comfort in prayer. And then we engage in these old fights, as our clergy call them, placing our flags along the theological landscape, potentially dimming our curiosity, our growth, our connections. You've heard me say time and again for 4 years how remarkable this congregation is, how healthy, how earnest it is in our want to love one another. And still, we are not without these challenges, these setups from our history and past. So today, the morning after another remarkable celebration of our community, wherein fun and joy and companionship met again in this space, an illustration of the kernel of this people, I want to address Ed's question more fully, for want to build, if not appreciation, then curiosity, safety maybe, in knowing where the humanists are today, and others too, so that this place can continue to grow in its love for one another while softening the fears, the disapproval, the discomfort of where we do not think alike. Now let me say, this should be a sermon series. I don't know who won the auction sermon last night. I hope it was Ed, but even if it wasn't, I am going to promise that in the year to come, I need to build into the worship calendar a sermon on humanists, with an emphasis on that S, because there are secular humanists, and then there are religious humanists, those who reject an idea of God, and then there are religious humanists who really don't give a hoot whether or not you believe in a higher power, just don't let it get in the way. And then there are all sorts of others in between and outside of that. Today is one avenue into this conversation, not the complete one. This is a day in which we stray from striving to be like-minded and instead focus on how we are heart-minded, how we are like-hearted, or how we can strive to be. But again, pulling away from that necessity that we all agree with one another in order to be in this space, especially when it comes to our theology. And I guess I'll also say, having done this one other time this morning, it's a little bit dense this morning. So the perfect sermon to give when you've been up really late. I'm going to ask that you look at the cover of your orders of service. And can anyone just shout out what you see, what that picture is on the cover? The universe. It is not Pluto, Greg. You were here for first service. Oh, I just assumed it was you, giving me a hard time. It's Earth. Does anyone know whose words those are on there? Carl Sagan, Bill Cox, it was such a joy to watch you walk in this morning. I knew you would know. It is the image that Carl Sagan describes as the pale blue dot. And those are his words. And let me give you a little bit more of what he says. He says, look at that dot. That is here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, who lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions and economic doctrines, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there on a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam. Dave thinks that we should just close out the service now and give us about 15 minutes to meditate on that. Now, I know that many of you have come into my office and you have seen the line of books that surround me, and you have seen what my influences have been and places and words that I find comfort in, and you have is lectured the right word, me about the worth of those books and those sacred texts. So I know that over the course of 4 years, this might surprise you to hear me say this, especially as somebody who uses words like prayer and divine and holy and has an association with that personal connection. But here's the thing. I am a humanist. I'm also a mystic. And not to dishonor Carl Sagan's memory, but I live and love and move because of both ends of that seemingly dichotomous spectrum, which it is not, in part because of his words and that image. There is a theological perspective called process theology. Who knows anything about process theology? Okay, we're going to go into the thick of process theology today. This is what I meant about it being a little dense, but here's why. Every Roots class, after I take us through, okay, so first we were this, and then we believed that, and this is why we believe this now, people say, but so where are we now? What do Unitarian Universalists believe? How do we express ourselves? I don't ever dare answer that question, but what I would want to say is process theology. And here's why. From my understanding, from watching my colleagues come into and grow, this is at least where many of our humanists are today. And many of our theists in our midst, too. Some secret home with a name that no one dares speak in fear of everyone rejecting out of a reaction that we can't possibly be inspired by the same thing while using such vastly different language. Here is the quick and dirty on process theology for you to chew on. And please keep in mind, you can study this for years. This is 5 minutes. So traditionally, it comes out of the want to understand God in a secular age, secular, non-religious. The idea of God, given the unending scientific discoveries that we have. As a colleague of mine explains, Alfred North Whitehead, he is a name that seminarians and clergy need to know. For our purposes today, he was an English mathematician, and he turned his attention to philosophy in the early 20th century. His most significant work came out in 1929 called Process and Reality, an Essay in Cosmology. Now, I know the natural cosmologists in the group are thinking that's the next book we will read, but what I promise you is it is not light reading. Whitehead acknowledged that new scientific understanding made it impossible to imagine the universe in a mechanical, linear paradigm with a God entirely external and superior, all-powerful, never-changing, the way Newton had. In place of this old paradigm, Whitehead said that we understand God and the universe and life itself not as objects, and I love this, but as events. Instead of life and God being nouns, Whitehead imagined them as verbs, dynamic and interactive and interrelated energies and actions, constantly changing but also creating and recreating by way of their interchange. Whereas we had come to understand each element in life, each person, each animal, everything, all as independent entities, Whitehead said that there was no such thing. There's no way to understand any portion of life without considering, as he says, the way in which it is interwoven with the rest of the universe. Humanists, mystics, theists, are you in disagreement with me yet? This is the process in process theology. So when someone asks me, do I believe in God, some higher power, some sense of the holy or the divine, I say, yes, because Whitehead made something external and parental and omnipotent that wished to still allow for pain and suffering into a creative interchange, a reality that contains all of us but is still larger than any of us. Again, Reverend Haley wrote, I am part of God in this system, and God is in part of me. You are a part of God, and God is a part of you, and God is a part of everything and everyone, past, present, future, the whole universe. Which is not to say that all of these parts are equally endowed with agency and awareness, but that all parts, to some degree or another, participate in creative and dynamic interchange of life. This works for me, as someone not only finds comfort in the traditional language of the religious world. This source of divinity is not outside the human experience, not foreign to the earth, not unreachable or even unimaginable. And yet, it is unimaginably larger and more powerful than this tiny experience that is my life. It is something I can draw on and look to both for comfort as well as disruption, for peace and for a charge. I am a humanist and I am a mystic. They are not in tension with one another, but constantly in conversation with all that I call the holy. And you see, if you take out that disruptive G word, which many of our new humanist preachers and theologians do not. They do not strip themselves of religious language, but speak instead of a non-supernatural theism, a God that is in the cosmos and a God that is also more than the cosmos. We can seek and name and bask in and be urged by a sacredness, a faith, an understanding and a making of meaning within the natural world, making process theology, in my mind at least, a dangerously seductive invitation out of the theological safe havens we have built around us. Astronauts and pilots have a name for what you may feel a small sense of when looking at that black and white image of that small, pale blue dot. It's called the overview effect. I think it's what Dave was getting at when he said, just stop there. It's what happens when you think you're headed out to see the sky, the moon, the universe, as you believe it to be, and come to realize that the remarkable part of your journey was actually the opportunity to look back at ourselves, at the city, the coherence to it all, and feel the weight of how often we fail to behave as such. We can't tell our children evolution loves you. And in a world that is lonely and craving connection that we know to be meaningful and trustworthy, it is important that we find stories and language and symbol that helps pull us from an isolation that goes against our souls and our nature. It is imperative that we reconnect our human experience, our thoughtful one, with a sense of awe, of connection, and of dependence. I tried so hard this morning to not say interdependence because I think it pulls us away from the most important part of that word. The humanists within Unitarian Universalism today are alive and well, and many, not all, but many have grown in their expressions of awe, their use of poetry, their reason to be religious. And I am grateful for this, for I lack the education, the insight, and awe that the natural cosmologists, the most traditional humanists here at UUCWC, have, likening it maybe to what I know about the sacred texts and other poetry. At our best, as Unitarian Universalists, we were not set up to make this faith easy or even pretty, but to help one another grow and, better yet, give the world options of entry from which we can enter to find one another, be inspired by one another, and define divinity together. We must soften our fears, and if not that, then our disapproval, our discomfort with what we believe is working against us, and come to name the beauty in what exists vehemently, proudly, and faithfully. It is, as Annie Dillard says, we are here to abet creation, as in abiding and abetting. We are here to assist creation, facilitate it. We are responsible for it, not to stand separate, but to join in partnership with all of it and with all other forces or events. That works for here, too. In praise of the creative interchange and of the questions that we continue to ask, blessed be.